You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us on this Friday, February the 16th. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock, and it's time for our Friday Week in Review, when we talk with two guests from different perspectives about the major news stories of the week. And I'm happy to have with us two of our best, two who are probably the only two in the world who are not Anna Nicole's baby's father.
Well, I thought we were going to talk about that, Joy.
Yeah, we might. You never know.
Might break some news here.
You know what? I did. Let me welcome our guest first. Ed Garvey is senior partner at the law firm of Garvey, McNeil & McGilvery. He's a former Democratic candidate for governor and for U.S. Senate, editor and publisher of FightingBob.com. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Joy. Sorry, I'm swallowing my coffee.
Drinking our bad coffee. And Rick Berg, former appointee in the Thompson administration, freelance writer and contributing columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal and the Capital Times. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. And member of the governing board of Common
That's
Cause.
That's right.
Will you be
Wisconsin.
Going to Washington when Tommy's elected president, or will you stay here in Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. I've been promised a big appointment out there, so I'm sure that'll be coming through soon.
The reason
Just have to hang on till then, Ed.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about Tommy yet again, who's keeps on visiting Iowa. Maybe we'll do that a little bit later. Last week, during the Week in Review, following the death of Anna Nicole, what's her last name?
Smith.
Anna Nicole Smith. I brought that up to our two guests during the Week in Review, saying, I know this isn't the most important, but isn't it interesting how it's dominated the news coverage? It's almost like she was the head of state, the way the cable channels were covering her death. And listeners yelled at me for talking about that and thinking I was wasting time talking about a celebrity, but I was looking at the media coverage of that. It really has taken over, hasn't
well,
it?
Well, her life and death is interesting and tragic in many different ways, but it is a fascinating cultural comment on where America is today, the amount of attention that's been focused on this issue. I mean, you know, the cable networks went wall to wall last Thursday when her unfortunate death was announced, and it was sort of amazing, and it does say something about the country and the media and beyond the circumstances, and it is sort of disappointing in many ways.
I promise I won't spend too much time on. Oh, did you have?
Well, I just say that the media today is fascinated with celebrity stuff because they don't deal with news
issues. Yeah, substance.
They don't deal with real stuff. So they have something like that, just wonderful, or O.J. Simpson, or anything that gets your attention away from Iraq and Iran and the Middle East and oil prices and the gap between the rich and the poor will suffice.
Unless listeners want to bring it up, that's the last word on Anna Nicole.
No
do you think it's the Republican mainstream media that's trying to divert attention from all those other issues then, Ed?
Is there any other?
Okay.
Some listeners yelled at me last week for talking about Anna Nicole, and another listener yelled at me that I spent too much time talking about the war in Iraq and the Iraq war resolutions and other things and not enough on the state of Wisconsin. So I'm going to let listeners yell at you guys. And Rick Berg, what do you want to talk about? You can start.
So you're going to put the onus on us now. They can yell at us.
He likes to get calls at home after 10.
Yeah, best after 10. That's the best time to reach me. I thought the state budget was interesting this week. When you look at it, and it's still being analyzed, and we're still discovering new tax hikes in the budget, but there is a slew of new tax hikes and fee increases in the budget that I think are just astonishing and I think unlike anything else we've seen in recent times. And then there's a bunch of funny money tricks in the budget like there have been in the past few biennial budget cycles. So once again, I think the story is that the state and the governor and the legislature, I think, both share blame for this. They're failing to address the underlying problems in the state budget, which is an ongoing structural deficit, an inability to control spending, a desire on the part of most taxpayers to keep taxes and fees down in the state of Wisconsin. They're going in the opposite direction. I think that's the biggest story, frankly, of the week. And it's been a story now, for those of us that have followed the budget cycle in Madison for the last 4 or 6 years or whatever, it's nothing new, but it's an acceleration of disturbing trends that we've seen in place for a long time now. I'm really rather troubled by it.
Ed, we'll let you pick the next topic, but first let's talk some about the state budget. What do you think about it?
Well, I think until we start dealing with some of the major issues, for example, the number of tax exemptions that have been given out to corporations, wouldn't it be refreshing if we just said, look, let's take all the tax exemptions, put them on the table, and say which ones should survive and which ones should be eliminated? if you eliminated the unneeded tax exemptions, we wouldn't have a budget, a structural deficit. We'd probably have a surplus. The second thing is I've had to spend a lot of time worrying about our prison population, thanks to being appointed to represent the inmates at Supermax. But until we deal with that issue, we're not going to have enough money for our university. Frank Remington years ago said, we'll face a moment where we have to choose between a great university system and a large prison population. And we've made that choice, unfortunately, and it is we'll go with the large prison population. The cost of keeping these people in prison, many of whom should not be in prison, is driving the budget in reality because there isn't enough money for lowering of tuition or taking care of health care and things of that nature.
Ed, didn't I just see in the paper that that Supermax inmate that your firm was representing got a couple hundred million dollars or something?
No, not
that. What was it?
Well, there are two settlements, one Nathan Gillis and the other one Canyon Thixton. And I'm happy to say that thanks to the work of Pam McGilvery, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said that the behavior modification program was comparable to a Soviet gulag in the 30s, and it was cruel and unusual punishment. So that paved the way for a settlement, and I think the end of that program, by the way. So, and we had another settlement last week, which will now have a three psychiatrists on a panel to make sure that no seriously mentally ill are sent to Supermax in the future.
Let's talk a little bit also about that's in the state budget, the crime lab problem. It's just somewhat related here. What do we need to do? Do we need to add more crime lab analysts to the state, or should we send this work out as some panel recommended yesterday? Rick Berg, any thoughts
on that? Well, as I recall, the new Attorney General, J.B. Van Hollen, had asked for 31 additional positions for the crime lab, and I think there were 15 positions that were allocated, at least in the budget that was proposed by Jim Doyle. My guess is that in the legislative wrangling that's going to now occur over the governor's proposed budget, you're going to see some debate on that particular issue, and that number may change before the final budget is adopted. But clearly, there's a problem with the crime lab. I mean, there's a significant delay, and they need more people to do the processing and the work that needs to be done to catch up on that backlog. So I guess you know, the ante that Van Hollen put on the table is 31 positions. Governor Doyle put 15 on the table, and maybe they're going to end up somewhere in between. But my guess is that they may end up closer to Van Hollen's number than Doyle's number. Because I think there is a fairly strong bipartisan consensus around this issue that we need to get caught up at the crime lab.
Well, you know, this is one of those issues that's kind of amazing because you get the surface issue, and that's the DNA testing. In fact, governors for the past couple of decades have been cutting back on state personnel, including the crime lab, and all of a sudden somebody runs on and sort of demagogues the issue, if you will, and suddenly everybody says, let's add 30 analysts. You know, maybe they need 10, maybe they need 5, they need something, but there ought to be an overall review of what the crime lab's mission is and how many people they need and how to make it more efficient. I don't know that the number is 30 or 15 or 10, but somebody needs to sit down and talk it through.
Let's listen to Governor Doyle during his state budget address on Tuesday night, one of the proposals.
Instead of asking our citizens to pay more in tolls or higher taxes, I think we should ask the oil companies to pay more. And so tonight...
Well, I'll finish that.
Applause.
He's
big oil, bashing big oil.
Yeah, wait a minute. One guy applauded the large profits of big oil. Remember that?
Yeah, Who was that?
Yeah, this guy from Waukesha. And he said, you know, unless they have profits, they can't do well and they help society and so on and so forth. So there is one out of a couple hundred.
Well, see, I think they need a tax on big lumber, too. You know, let's hike the fees on big lumber and then plow that back into the reforestation program. And then we'll forbid lumber companies from passing the increased costs on to builders and home buyers, too. So, I mean, it's a slippery slope. Yeah, I knew you'd embrace it, Ed.
There's $100 I'm going to give to public.
The danger in throwing things out like that is that Ed may embrace it. But the fact of the matter is there's no practical way to enforce that. I mean, what is the governor going to do? Sick the Department of Revenue on the books of big oil to audit them to see if they're passing on costs? The oil operates in a marketplace. The price goes up, the price goes down, and a lot of things influence that. Futures markets,
oligopolies,
refineries, exploration, etc., and sources, whether sources are drying up and the House of Saud or whatever in Arabia. But the fact of the matter is it's a dynamic marketplace. And so I don't know how in the world Governor Doyle thinks that he's going to somehow enforce a requirement that these costs not be passed on to the consumers. Everything gets passed on to the consumers. We know that.
Well, I think he's making a good faith effort. The fact is that the profits that these oil companies are making is scandalous. It's absolutely incredible, and it's the hidden tax on working people who have to drive to work every day. So I applaud his efforts.
Well, but I'd also, interestingly enough, someone should ask the question, how much has the State Investment Board made in investments with ExxonMobil? You see, there are people that benefit from the profits.
I think you're right. Let's get them out of there.
Well, no, but the profits are very high, and in some cases ridiculously high. I don't necessarily disagree with that.
Berg calls for social investment.
No, but at the same time, you have to recognize that there are people who benefit from that, and people who hold stock or investments in those companies are benefiting as a result of that.
If you
have a pension with the Wisconsin investment or with the Wisconsin retirement system, chances are you're benefiting through some
Rick,
of those profits.
You're not old enough to remember. We used to have a Justice Department. There was actually an antitrust division, and they went after people like this.
I don't remember that.
Let me take a short pause, and then we'll get to a couple of callers who also want to talk about some items in the state budget proposal. We are reviewing the news of the week right now on the topic of Governor Doyle's budget proposal that he delivered to the legislature on Tuesday night. We'll move on to some other issues as the hour goes along, and we welcome your calls on the issue that matters to you. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And Madison 263-1890. Our two guests this week for the Week in Review, Rick Berg and Ed Garvey. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Friday Week in Review, and this afternoon after 4 o'clock, it's Ben Marins with his regular Friday feature, Your Views on the News. Talking this hour with Rick Berg and Ed Garvey about the news of the week, talking about the state budget right now, and a couple of callers want to talk about some items in the state budget, too, including Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My subject, of course, is corrections again, because I think correction budget reflects the fact that we have bought into the last 30 years, 25 years, into a population that's increased to about three times what Minnesota's is on a comparable basis, 22,000 versus 7,000. And the question would be is, what have we done wrong? Are we that much different than Minnesota? And I think the question would have to focus on the disproportionate number of blacks and other minorities in our prisons. The governor mentioned this in his State of the Union, and by implication, that would be one way to take a look at reducing prison population. Can't the government do this by edict? The governor himself has the powers to reduce the number of people within prisons and save us some money.
The biggest problem is that you have a competition between the two parties. Who's tougher on crime than the other? And so you have this chest thumping that says, I am stronger and I'm going to build a supermax prison that'll be for the worst of the worst. It'll be the worst prison in America to punish people. And we have this sort of punishment ethic. So when we have the governor, he's afraid to say anything about letting more people out or having those who are addicted to drugs and alcohol in rehab rather than prison, or who have driven after their license has been revoked in some kind of a training program. But something has to happen because we're going broke. We used to joke during when I ran against Tommy that his vision of Wisconsin was very large prisons connected by very wide highways. And I think that's about where we are. But you mentioned Minnesota. They are doing something right, and we ought to bring them over here to talk to our Department of Corrections. But the Department of Corrections can't do anything unless the legislature or the governor have the courage to say, we have to do something about reducing this population. It is ridiculous.
Well, Ed's right. I mean, there has been a competition, and it's been underway for a long time. I mean, that's what leads to silly stuff like three strikes and you're out, which is, you know, sort of a non-discriminating way of looking at incarceration. I think people that commit violent crimes and serious crimes probably belong in prison. I don't necessarily agree that people who commit other sorts of offenses belong in prison, and maybe there are treatment options that would be better suited for them. But it's both parties, and they've been doing it for a long time.
And instead of rehabilitation, which used to be what we thought about, now we have over 60% of the inmates who can't read above the third grade level. We have a lot of people who have mental illness and other problems. They ought to be the goal here ought to be to teach them to read, teach them a craft, so that when they get out, they can find work. The problem they have now is they're going to go right back into the prison.
Well, that's especially true in Wisconsin, because one of the issues that Wisconsin's been grappling with over the past 6-7 years is the issue of the shortage of skilled workers in the state. And if you listen to people talk about it who are very familiar with it, they're very concerned about where the workers are going to come from in future years as more and more people retire and all that. And so if there is a percentage of the population that is incarcerated that can be rehabilitated and turned into productive members of society, and you give them some skills to allow them to reenter the workforce, I think that's a positive for the state.
Let me ask you both about this. Governor Doyle signed a bill last May calling for lifetime tracking of sexually violent predators and child molesters using GPS or global positioning technology. But the budget proposal scales back the law so that only those offenders on parole or supervised release would be tracked. It's not going to be a lifetime thing. The author of this bill, Republican from Abbotsford, Scott Souter, can't believe it. The Corrections Department says there's just too many problems in trying to track these people for life. What do you think, Ed Garvey?
This is another one of those where we can do all sorts of things and spend hundreds of millions of dollars. But the fact is, what do you do if somebody enters into the wrong area? Do we send in a strike force to get them out of that area?
Right.
I mean, somehow society has to deal with its problems. And Scott Souter says, let's spend millions of dollars tracking people. This is where I think Ed Thompson and the libertarians would agree with us that, there is a limit to what government ought to do in terms of following people, opening mail, checking you out, GPS system, computer chips in your car so they know where you are. I mean, there is a limit, and I think that goes beyond reasonable limits.
Well, I'd like to think there's a limit, but, the way society and the culture is moving these days, I'm not sure that's the case. I mean, you look at OnStar technology with GM. The technology that allows them to shut your car off or unlock your doors, and they're nowhere near.
They went broke though.
Yeah, well, only because of the digital conversion on the cell towers.
Okay.
But the newer GM cars have it. But the fact of the matter is, it's been a trend for a long time in the society, and frankly, I'm sort of concerned about it too. I tend to agree with the libertarians there. I don't want the government snooping around everything I do.
I don't mind if I'm the government, but if Berg is, then
then he's really worried.
We'll let Ken in Milwaukee in on the conversation. Hi, Ken.
Good morning.
Morning.
The governor had announced week before last, and now in his budget, a plan, or Milwaukee plan, I guess is what it would be called. And I'd like to narrow it down to a part of it where it talks about giving or assisting, pardon me, Milwaukee with additional monies for their school system because choice schools were created, and there's approximately 24,000 students that go there, and it costs the city of Milwaukee resident about $1,000 more for each one of these students. And the governor's proposal was to assist Milwaukee in helping to pay for the way those kids have the opportunity to get their education. And I'd like to know if Rick and Ed think that assisting Milwaukee for a school district, if I can call it that, that was created by the rest of the state legislators, because we have representative government, shouldn't the state help us with that? And I'm hoping that it would be something that could be approved and see done. We could use the extra $2 million or so that it costs to have these 24,000 students separately educated.
Do you get what exactly Ken wants?
Yeah, okay. I am unalterably opposed to the idea of school vouchers. I mean, I believe in public education, and the governor, I think, is making a mistake by saying he's going to pick up the cost. I think the money ought to go into the public schools. The Milwaukee Public Schools actually do a very good job. If you go through the schools, you talk to the teachers, they're dedicated people. And they just need some more attention and some more help. It's a statewide problem. It ought to be dealt with statewide. And, the voucher program is this Bradley Foundation idea that we can privatize education, get to virtual schools and things of that nature. I think we need strong public schools, and that means picking up more than the two-thirds requirement for the cost of education.
Well, I like strong public schools, and I like effective public schools, but unlike Ed, I do like school choice and school vouchers. I think the competition is actually healthy.
Go to your room.
Yeah, I know. Go to the corner. I think competition is healthy for public schools, and I was saying this way back in the mid-90s. I mean, I think that in cases like Milwaukee, where you've got a real urban crisis in education, the kind of competition you get from private school choice and vouchers is exactly what's needed, because it forces the public schools to do things differently. Now, there's a real problem in Milwaukee. I mean, the statistics are alarming. I think just one recent study said that 55% of all the new births to minority parents in Milwaukee are to single parents. We've got a serious crime problem in Milwaukee. The schools have long been a problem and concern in Milwaukee. And the health of Milwaukee is very important to the rest of the state. Milwaukee, it's important for Wisconsin to have Milwaukee do well and for people to succeed there and get a good education, a good foundation in life. And anything that the state can do to help bring that about, I think, is generally a good idea.
Let's welcome in another caller, King in Belgium. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. The governor is looking to tax mobile, and he says they make an obscene amount of money. Oh. And mobile does a lot of exploration and things that take a lot of that, and it eats away at their profits. Their profit is 9%. Why doesn't the governor go into something like the casinos? And Ed, what do you think about the profits from the lawyer that the lawyers make?
Lawyers, profits.
I didn't know.
What?
I thought we were all in this.
No, there's news.
Public service. This is a shock.
Tax. Yeah.
I think that I have advocated, for example, sales tax. There's no reason why professional fees shouldn't. They shouldn't pay sales tax. That's an exemption that I think should go out the window. So if that helps in the answer, but. Somehow or other, we have to look at all these exemptions and say which ones would make sense. The machinery and equipment exemption, for example, you could build an ethanol plant, and they say, oh, we're going to bring in all this money, but you really don't, because they're only taxed on the frame of the building as opposed to all the equipment, so it doesn't really bring much money into the community. There ought to be some review of that so that perhaps it's cut in half, and therefore we can start to generate some more revenue.
Yeah. Now, besides
well,
the, oh, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to talk about that for a second because and this goes back to something Ed was saying earlier about the exemptions, the sales tax exemptions. It seems to me what's lacking in the state is the political courage and will to do what needs to be done. I think most people that have tracked these issues would agree that the financing system for public education is busted in this state. It doesn't mm-hmm. work well. The whole issue of sales tax exemptions needs to be examined and looked at, and in terms of revenue. And nobody is willing to take those issues on. And so we get these phony baloney budgets that are held together, with paste and glue and tape and funny money shifts in the budget. But nobody really wants to tackle the serious issues.
And why?
I know why. Money. Well, it's the printout. The winners, the losers. As soon as you start tinkering with a system, there are going to be winners and losers, and then there's a political fallout that accrues to both parties. But it seems to me that is the fundamental underlying problem, that we have a lack of political courage in this state to really attack the issues that need to be addressed. And no one is showing leadership on that.
We call it the lobbyist legislature for a reason.
I know.
The amount of money that's poured into these campaigns. The Democracy Campaign pointed out that $30 million was spent on the gubernatorial race last year. It's just obscene. And with that kind of money having to be raised, people give that money for a reason. They don't give it to you because you're good looking, or Rick would have been elected, and I would have
right.
still
if
we, lost.
Right. If good looking, nice guys were
elected.
I still
would have lost.
Yeah, we'd both be in office.
Rick, I wanted to go back to where we first started, though, on the budget before we let Ed pick the next topic since we've been going.
Outrageous.
Lots to talk about with the state budget, though. So you said that there was a lot of tax increases and not a lot of spending cutbacks. Besides the proposed tax on oil and the cigarette tax, And maybe it'll cost more to register our cars. How are we being taxed more?
Well, you know, the State Journal did an interesting breakdown. I think it was in yesterday's paper. We got the cigarette tax going from 77 cents to $2.02. The tax on other tobacco products increased 40.6%. Registration fees on cars would go from $55 to $75. Getting a driver's license would go to $34 from $24. We would allow the tax levies to increase by 4% as opposed to 2%
locally. It's not fair to bring facts into this.
I know. Yeah, the real estate transfer tax would go from $3 to $5 per $1,000 on the sale. Digital downloads, dry cleaning, guns, elk, hospital taxes, vital records.
Elk.
Don't tax my elk.
Birth certificates, $12 to $20. You know, so the list goes on and on and on. I mean, from birth to death and everything you do, virtually, at some point when you get up in the morning to the end of the day, almost everything people do in that time period, there's going to be a tax or a fee hike that's going to have an impact.
The one that won't go through is the one on births, because the right to life people will make sure that that's...
Yeah.
One more call on this, and then we will move on. John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Yeah, I want to know why the governor doesn't tax the gas versus raising the prices of licenses, driver's licenses, because wouldn't it spread the cost out for all the people that are not from our state that are using our highways?
Good thought.
Yeah. Well, the other point that needs to be made here, and I'm sorry to be the one to make it, but when going back to the big oil, you know, we want big oil now to pay for roads in the state of Wisconsin. Well, the fact of the matter is that I think over the last two or three years, the governor and the legislature have moved about $1.2 billion from the transportation fund over to public education. Now, that's a massive shift of money away from roads and to public schools. Now, you can argue, I'm not suggesting that public schools aren't important, but the fact of the matter is that they've taken money from the transportation fund, a significant amount of money that wasn't available to do the projects that needed to be done. And now they come to us and say, oh, my gosh, our roads are terrible. We've got to do something. We need to put money. So big oil is going to have to pay for it. But if they had left those funds alone and done what should have been done, which was honest budgeting 2 years ago, 4 years ago, we wouldn't be in this situation today.
I think that was you clapping at the governor's.
No, that wasn't.
With global warming now, absolute reality, we know that it's here. It's going to have disastrous consequences, perhaps the end of life on this planet. To be debating over transportation policies and building more roads, we ought to be figuring out public transportation and alternative fuels, because we're doomed unless we do something. And this administration in Washington has still got its head in the sand so far that it's absurd, except that the president now sort of acknowledges that something's going on.
Well, if we're doomed, I would like to think that Governor Doyle would move to dramatically decrease taxes so we would all have more money to enjoy what time is left.
Oh, my.
Senator Mark Miller and State Representative Spencer Black have introduced legislation that would make Wisconsin the second state in the nation to pass a law requiring lowering greenhouse gases. It would require carbon dioxide emissions to be reduced to 1990 levels by 2020. You like that, Ed Garvey?
I do like it, and what I really would like would be a public service commission that's dedicated to the ratepayers and not just the utilities, that would do some planning and enforce these things. The problem we've had is that the PSC has been taken over by the utilities, and unless the governor appoints someone really strong to replace the retiring member of the PSC, none of this is going to become a reality.
Mm-hmm. Rick Burke?
Well, I would support anything that improves air quality in the state of Wisconsin. I don't know all the details of what they're proposing.
No more speeches by politicians.
Well, that I would limit them, yes. Right. I would limit them. That's a good place to start. I would limit the length of those speeches, because that would improve air quality. But I don't know. The practical implications I'm not so familiar with. But in general, it's not necessarily a bad idea. It depends on how they want to implement it.
Well, Ed Garvey gets to pick the next topic, which we will do right after this break. Ed Garvey, senior partner at the law firm of Garvey, McNeil & McGilvery, a former Democratic candidate for governor and U.S. Senate editor and publisher of FightingBob.com, and Rick Berg, who is a governing member of Common Cause Wisconsin, a former appointee in the Thompson administration, freelance writer. Our number, if you'd like to talk about an issue in the news this week, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, and you're listening to The Week in Review. Our two guests today, Rick Berg and Ed Garvey. And Ed, I promised you get to choose the next topic. What happened in the news this week that you think we should talk about?
I think the question of whether September 8th is the best day for Bob Fest number 6.
1-800.
If it's going to be as cold as last year, I say yes.
So, I think it's Iran.
I think it's Iran. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton gave a speech to APEC, the American-Israeli Political Education Committee, in which she said all options are on the table, which included, of course, the bombing of Iran. And the more we listen to the Bush administration, this anonymous news conference they had in Baghdad, that they have Iranian weapons, it took the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to say nonsense before the administration backed off, but it looked like a pretext for war. Zbigniew Brzezinski testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he said it looks just like the Iraq buildup. And so I'm scared that Cheney will say that the way to get people's attention off the loss in Iraq and Afghanistan is to start a war with Iran.
I'm not scared. I'm concerned about the saber rattling, but I'm not really concerned that the United States is on the verge of bombing Iran or Tehran. I think that's highly unlikely. It would be untenable, I think, in the current political environment. I've said it before in this show. I think if there's something to be taken care of in Iran, my bet would be on the Israelis taking care of it, not the United States.
But they won't take care of it. If they start it, we'll be in it. That's the problem. So it's not just our government, but it could well be the Israeli government that does it.
Well, I don't think you're going to see the United States instigating an armed conflict with Iran in the immediate future. I really hope not. I hope not, and I don't expect it.
And I assume you're also supporting the resolution in the House of Representatives.
No, sir, I'm not. No, sir. You mean the surrender defeat?
I'm taking back the $100.
Now, why do you call that the surrender defeat resolution?
Because the Democrats have no plan for victory. I mean, I understand the hatred of George Bush. I understand the mistakes that have been made in the implementation of the war strategy. I understand the missteps of Donald Rumsfeld. I understand all of that, and I'm painfully aware of it. But at the same time, we have a lot at stake in Iraq, and we have a lot, I think, on the line in that country in terms of trying to help the Iraqi people. When you look at the Democrats, they seem to be playing out their hatred for Bush, their hatred for Rumsfeld, political posturing for 08, and they don't seem to be confronting the real issues in Iraq, and that is, how do we achieve success? Now, if the Democrats do not believe that success is possible, fine, then they should say so and say, you know, we're for defeat, we have been defeated, we need to get out of that country, and at least be honest about it. But this whole resolution opposing the Bush strategy to me seems disingenuous in the sense that they have no strategy for success or victory in Iraq. Nothing.
It's like the old definition of a recession is when your neighbor loses his job. A depression is when you lose your job. When I listen to these hawks on the floor of the House sending other people's children over to die in Iraq and saying that we're looking for defeat, I just get crazy. For heaven's sakes, we've lost all of these young people. About 60,000 people a month are leaving Iraq and becoming refugees. Probably 300,000 to 500,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed. It is a six-letter word, fiasco. This is the most poorly managed situation that anyone could imagine. We can't win, and we are causing more problems than we're solving by being there. So it's not a question of winning and losing. We have lost, and I think everyone acknowledges that.
Well, but in a time of war, and that is what this is. I mean, the president has a strategy, and I know the Democrats disagree with it. But
what's his strategy?
The strategy is to provide more troops. The surge strategy is to provide more troops to try to secure Baghdad and stabilize the situation there, which I think is a fine goal. It's not a long window that the president has asked for. I mean, it's a relatively short window, and I think he knows.
But if your son were over there right now, I think he might have a different view of the surge. And this is why I think unless we perhaps listen to Charlie Rangel and say, let's reinstitute the draft with no deferments, America is going to continue to be an adventurous nation. even Putin is now saying, you know, that sort of problem. People want weapons of mass destruction to protect themselves against the invasion from the United States. There's something that's gone really wrong.
Yeah. Ed Garvey, why, though, does it matter if Congress or the House passes a non-binding resolution criticizing the surge?
Well, I would prefer that they take up the Feingold resolution, of course, and stop the funding, or Dennis Kucinich in the House. But I think it is important. If you get, and it looks like there are going to be 50 to 60 Republicans joining with the Democrats in condemning this surge, there's a strong message to the president that this has got to stop. It's going to stop anyway because it can't possibly succeed given the fact that they're in the middle of a civil war. But I think, you know, you take what you can get, and if we get the resolution, I'm happier than if we were to defeat it. I'd be much happier if Feingold's resolution went through.
Yeah. And really, just to say, we disagree, we criticize this surge, Rick Berg. Really, what's wrong with that?
Well, because it seems to me that our national interest is in succeeding in Iraq and stabilizing the situation in Iraq and making sure that the country has a fair chance to achieve what has never been achieved in the Middle East, which is a functioning democracy, at least in an Arab country. And so it seems to me that that is in our national interest. Chaos is not in our national interest. Leaving Iraq to, you know, in a state of civil war to tear itself apart is not in our national interest. So, you know, it's okay, I guess, to criticize the plan and the strategy, but at the same time, I think it's incumbent on those that criticize it to offer up some plan of their own for how we're going to succeed. And withdrawal and cutting off funding is not a plan to succeed, that's a plan to fail and admit defeat, and I'm not so sure that that's in our national interest.
I just saw, I'm looking for the story that Joe Biden yesterday or the day before is suggesting that Congress should vote on a resolution taking back the authority to go to war for that President Bush had because, you know, because of the false pretenses.
Just cut off the funds. I mean, who cares about taking back the resolution? I think if they start cutting off the funds, that's the only way that they're going to stop this mayhem.
Now, Paul in Madison is with us. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Yes, Dennis Murtha has got a plan that he floated yesterday saying that they would not allow, that the Congress can't stop the war, but they can keep the Pentagon from extending tours of duty, starting people early, or sending people back before they had their units had a chance to refit and be ready for combat again. He would not allow the Pentagon to put any unit into harm's way that has not been, you know, let's say, rearmed, and are ready for combat. We are now sending troops into Baghdad that don't have the latest armor for their Humvees.
Yeah, Jack Murtha's plan a good idea, Ed Garvey?
Well, sure. I mean, but you know, I look at these soldiers and imagine just put yourself in their position, putting all that gear on, going door to door in a country where they can't speak the language, don't know the culture, have no idea, you know, what's around the next corner. You can't win a war like that. I mean, this is we have known that since our Revolutionary War in this country. The problem is that this has been a fiasco. They were wrong in the way they implemented it. They lied to get us into it. They've mismanaged it. Halliburton has made billions of dollars in profits. What we have here is American soldiers as targets who have no chance of really succeeding.
Well, you know, I think it also points out why it's best not to conduct war by committee. I mean, lied to get us into it. Well, let's go back to World War II. I mean, there's a case that can be made there that you know, FDR either knew about or allowed the attack at Pearl Harbor to occur. I mean, there's a body of thought that says that we either passively allowed it to occur or we knew it was going to occur and specifically allowed it to happen because he wanted a pretext to get into the war. And then when you look at the conduct of war, I mean, the Battle of the Bulge in World War II, you know, what if Congress at that point said, oh, my God, look, we're getting beat back. We're getting beaten back. That, you know, no, it's legitimate, Ed. The fact of the matter is that the president has the authority to conduct war in conjunction with the military experts. And there's a reason why we don't want politicians necessarily micromanaging wars.
Yeah, but there's
and
also
responding to public opinion polls.
There is a reason we didn't set up separate intelligence agencies so that were run by the Secretary of Defense as opposed to the CIA and the Defense Information Agency and so on. What we have here are, you know, people, forget about the start of the war. The fact that it is now such a disaster that the only hope we have is to get out. And the question is not whether, it's just when.
Well, but you know, just look at the Iraqi people. We betrayed them once in the early 90s. Do you remember the early 90s when we kicked them out of Kuwait?
And Colin Powell wisely said, don't go into Baghdad.
Right, but at the same time, we encouraged them to revolt against the regime. Now, how many thousands of Iraqis died because they took the suggestion that they try to mount a revolt against Hussein in 1991, 92, or whatever. The United States failed to support it. The point is, We have made a commitment to the Iraqi people. Now, and granted,
but they want us to get out. I mean, all the surveys tell us that the Iraqi people say, get out.
But if they
want us to get out, let's get out.
I don't think that the majority of Iraqis want their country to fall into total chaos.
It's total chaos now, right?
It is not total chaos throughout the country, Ed. There are problems in Baghdad and some of the other urban areas, but it is not total chaos. And there are good things happening in Iraq. There are bad things happening in Iraq. My point is that I don't think that it's morally defensible to again leave the Iraqis in the lurch and defend for themselves. I think we have made a commitment to help that country, to help those people, and I think it's important that we do everything possible to try to fulfill that commitment and help them succeed.
President Bush is ordering an increase in forces in Afghanistan. He's extending the stay of 3,200 troops now in the country for 4 months and will deploy a replacement force that will sustain the increase for the foreseeable future. Fears that Afghanistan is going to blow up this spring.
History teaches that no one can occupy Afghanistan. The Soviets learned it, the British learned it, and now we're learning it. The only question there, again, is how long will it be before the United States pulls out of Afghanistan? I mean, if you just look at the situation, we can't continue to be the only imperial power in the world. There is a limit to the resources that we have and to the people who are willing to sign up for the armed forces. I mean, we're looking at trillions of dollars of debt as a result of this war. And Afghanistan, at least they're using NATO, but in Iraq, it's really now just the United States and still a couple of British soldiers.
Well, I think the additional troops for Afghanistan are merely to make sure that the situation there remains as stable as possible, and they don't follow in terms of what's going on in Iraq. They don't want the same thing to happen in Afghanistan.
But it's happening.
It's dicey. Well, it is dicey. There's no doubt about that.
Well, one reason it's happening is because Pakistan is working with the Taliban, and we can't stop them from doing it. So what you have is an almost impossible situation, again, putting our troops in a situation where they can't possibly really affect the long-term outcome of.
Well, it's a difficult situation. Sure, the Taliban is you know, reconstituting, and they're all hiding out in the mountains along the Pakistan-Afghan border.
They should stand up and fight like real soldiers.
Well, they should, and put on uniforms and go toe-to-toe. I mean, instead of bombing civilians and marketplaces, absolutely, put on uniforms and take us on. Let me switch topics.
It's related, but I want to talk a little bit of presidential campaign politics for the next few minutes. Hillary Clinton was in New Hampshire doing some stumping in New Hampshire last weekend, and she was asked by a Democratic primary voter to whether or not she was ready to admit that she made a mistake when she voted for the resolution authorizing the war. And he said, I want you to answer this in simple terms and without nuance. Did you make a mistake? And here's what she said.
Well, I have said, and I will repeat it, that knowing what I know now, I would never have voted for it. But I also, and I mean, obviously, you have to weigh everything as you make your decisions. I have taken responsibility for my vote. The mistakes were made by this president, who misled this country and this Congress into a war that should not have been waged.
Now, that's not exactly what this voter wanted to hear. Ed Garvey, does she have to say, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have authorized
it's not
that.
Just the vote. She supported this effort all the way through.
I mean,
so she's been one of the leaders talking about the training of the Iraqi army and so on. When she says she took responsibility for her vote, she has not. I mean, the Congress has stood by and watched this administration, fall into this abyss. So I think it certainly was nuanced. She's trying to pull a Bill Clinton, and she can't pull it off because she doesn't have that same confidence that he had. But
she's trying to pull a John Kerry too. I was for it before I was against it, sort of thing.
So I think that she's not going to get the support of Democrats in the primary.
Hmm. Well,
she's got a problem. Yeah, she's got a problem with Democratic voters, absolutely, because they're They're as hard left as the Republican primary voters are hard
right. Where is this hard left? I've been looking for it for years. I want them. Come call me at home.
Yeah. So, Ed Garvey, who's going to get the Democratic primary voter support?
I think it's going to be Barack Obama or John Edwards. I think the two of them offer, or perhaps Richardson. You know, they're good candidates, and Obama has more charisma than anyone I've seen since Bobby Kennedy. I think he's, you know, he's smart. He's, you know, he gets along. He doesn't come off as an arrogant politician. I thought his response to the Australian Prime Minister was just classic. When the Australian Prime Minister criticized mm-hmm. Obama's position on Iraq, Obama said, well, I think he's got a, you know, maybe 1,000 troops there. Why doesn't he send 21,000 troops there from Australia?
Yeah.
You know, that wouldn't happen with most politicians. So I think it's going to be an exciting primary. I'm very enthused about it, and perhaps we'll be at Bob Fest on September 8th.
Will Barack be there?
Well, I don't
will
know.
Will Barack? Will it be Obama Fest?
Wouldn't that be great?
Call it Obama Fest this
there you
year.
Go. All right.
What do you think? Let's talk about some of the Republican candidates. Rudy Giuliani is saying he's going to run, even though he hasn't made the official announcement yet.
He's in.
Yeah, he's running.
He's in. Sure. Yeah. Giuliani will be in. Romney announced this week that he's in. You know, the big three in the Republican fight continue to be McCain, Romney, Giuliani. And it'll be interesting to watch how I think Romney and Giuliani will have to do the most dancing, you know, to sort of position themselves to appeal to the right wing of the Republican Party anyway.
Well, Romney's already done it. Suddenly now he's anti-choice. And,
yeah, well, Giuliani's
anti-gay.
Sort of doing it, too. But they know, I mean, well, the fact of the matter is that the candidates in both parties know what they have to do in order to appeal to the people that are going to turn out and vote in their primaries in 08. For the Democrats, it's going to be those people that are moving to the left.
They don't speak their conscience? They calculate?
No, I'm sorry to explain this reality of politics.
No wonder I lost.
Yeah, see, principle doesn't count for much in this day and age yet. Let me tell you, convictions count for a little less. It'll be interesting to watch how they position themselves and appeal to those people that are going to be voting in the Republican primary. Because frankly, Giuliani and Romney are probably a little too far to the left for a lot of those right-wing Republican voters. And so there's going to be some difficult choices for the Republicans in 08. But I think in the end, Republicans will make a pragmatic choice of who has the best chance of, you know, being a victor in November of 08. And I think a lot of them will recognize that it's not going to be a terribly conservative candidate.
Here's the scary part. None of us will have anything to say about it. There's a small group of people in this country who will put in hundreds of millions of dollars to determine who the Democrat will be and who the Republican will be. That's what is frightening.
Well,
they're talking about a billion-dollar race for President of the United States.
I know.
And so, you know, somebody's going to put in $200 million for Giuliani and he'll become the nominee, and somebody will put $300 million in for Hillary Clinton and she'll become the nominee.
The bets are being put down as we speak.
Yeah.
Right. And the one that gets the most money is likely the one that's going to prevail, just like in the gubernatorial race in Wisconsin.
Let's have a sit-in here at public radio until they have public financing of the president.
A telethon here. Okay.
Let's occupy the
studio, Ed.
We have 1 minute to go, and I forgot to bring up an issue that both of you said you wanted to talk about at the beginning of the hour, the partial veto power of Wisconsin's governor.
Oh, yeah.
Democrats in the state legislature, in the Senate, have decided not to vote on this and let the governor have this power during this budget session. You think that power is a bad idea?
Yeah, briefly, it's a mistake. I mean, it's been called the Frankenstein veto authority, whatever. It's an enormously powerful veto authority that the governor has had, and we have seen it used now by both Republicans and Democrats, and I think the results have been appalling, and it's time to bring that authority to an end. Absolutely.
30 seconds. Well, that was 30 seconds. And what's happening on September 8th again?
Bob Fest. Oh,
all right. Obama Fest. No, it's Obama Fest.
Yeah. Ed Garvey, thank you very much for being here. We'll see you soon. And Rick Burke, thank you as well.
Thanks, Joy.
Our Friday Week in Review guest. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing this hour. And thank you for listening and for calling in. Hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.